Kevin Smith directed and acted in his New Jersey Chronicles, Clerks, Mallrats, Chasing Amy, Dogma, and the final chapter, Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. Through his work, Smith presents his own lens through which we may view the world. And although it is not always rose-colored, we learn by looking through it a new way to examine spirituality, sexuality, and human relationships. And now, let's give it up for Kevin Smith.
There's signs that say applause, because I don't think I've ever gotten a reaction like that. Kind of reaction like that just makes up for every chick ever said I had a small dick. So. You know, we'll just sit here until you're all quiet and then make up the time afterwards. Are we starting on this side? Is that why the camera's in his face? First one of the night, dude.
All right, first question. What's a Nubian? I'm kidding. I'm sure that's a
not
person.
For nothing, but I will do the fucking jokes. Oh.
Well, they weren't all my questions. No. Actually, I got a lot, but big question right now. I haven't heard the answer before. You probably have stated it, but you know, you're Silent Bob in the movies. You wrote and directed. Why give yourself the Marcel Marceau part?
I'm sorry. I stopped listening.
No.
Why give myself the Marcel Marceau part? I would think it's obvious. I can't really act. Which is why I wrote a movie in which I was the lead. Because it's America, damn it.
You know?
It happened by accident. I'd actually written the role of Randall to play myself way back when I wrote Clerks, which is why Randall has all the best jokes. But as we got closer to production, I was like, who am I kidding? I can't act. Like, I can't memorize dialogue. It's impossible. Who can memorize all this shit in particular? A lot of dirty words in that script. So I bowed out, and I gave the part to Jeff Anderson, a dude who I'd went to high school with, who never showed any interest in acting and just wound up being the perfect guy for the part. And then I said, if this is the only flick I'm going to make, I at least want to be in it. Because I want to be able to look back years from now when I'm still paying off, you know, $28,000 in credit card debt. Get together with my friends, get really fucking drunk. And be like, remember the worst mistake of my life? The one I'm still paying for? Here it is. I'm in it. Wait, here it comes. Look at that jackass. I at least wanted to be in it. So I looked through the script. I was like, what's left? And I said, you know, Silent Bob. It was a part I'd written for a friend of mine named Michael Bellicus. And he wound up in the movie. He's the guy that plays the dude who comes to the counter. And Dante's like, my girlfriend's like 37 dicks. And he says, in a row? You guys are easy. Now I'm just like going to read from my scripts. Then on page 19 in Chasing Amy, Banky said this. He was supposed to be Silent Bob. I'd written the part for him because I thought he would look good next to Muse, because Muse is kind of thin and always moving, and Mike was the opposite. And I said, wait a second, I'm way bigger than Mike. I'm way less mobile and way stockier. So I said, I'll do it, and I don't have to memorize any fucking dialogue, and I'll look good standing next to Muse. Plus, Muse was not real reliable when it came to acting. So I could stand there and just pinch him the whole time. Which is why if you look at Clerks and look at all the other movies, we stand very closely in Clerks. And if you look, sometimes you see me going like... I'm just like, ow! Oh, Snoogans, yeah. Thank you. Because it's really, it is kind of like two steps away from... So I jumped into that role just because I wanted to be in it and not memorize dialogue, having no idea that I would be so bereft of original ideas that I would keep those characters coming back. You know, I assumed I put Jay, I wrote the role of Jay for Jason Mewes, and I put it in there because I wanted to see him act, and I always thought he was funny, wanted to see if other people would find him funny. And I jumped in for the reason I explained, and I said, you know, this is it. It's one time I'll ever be in the flick. I don't know if we'll ever make another one. And then we kept going, and I kept bringing back the characters because, A, I'm not very creative, and B, because I think Jason Mewes is very funny. So I kept coming back with him. You don't want to split him up. So I just kind of, you know, stepped into it quite by accident.
Thanks, and on behalf of all big men everywhere, doing a good job.
Don't lump me in with you. See, I could say I'm fat. When you say it, it's insulting.
I've been watching his movies for a really long time. I love every single one of them. The first one I saw was Mallrats. I just fell in love with him after that.
The first thing I ever saw was Mallrats, and I just thought it was funny, and I connected to it for some odd reason.
I love his dialogues in some of his movies, like just like the random like rampage people go on, you know, like especially in Clerks. Me and my buddy Jay here have spent a lot of time mentoring ourselves in the way of Jay and Silent Bob. It's you know, ever since, you know, Clerks really, really started off. It's a whole new breed and a whole new era of movie making that he's brought on, and everything from the Jersey Shore has just been wonderful. Kevin, thanks a lot, man. It's been a great ride.
Do you think that this guy looks like you over here?
Thank you.
That's Nathan and Gene. I'm in a sketch comedy group with them. And we also wanted to know if you wanted to hang out with us after. Maybe go home, drink some beer, you know. Got a big house.
Yeah, especially after that. Yeah. You guys had a little shtick going on. It was so cute. Got right up and went right into this. You be Jay. I'll be Simon. It's tremendous. Don't ever fucking do that again. That routine is copyrighted. Does the cat look like me? I don't know, a little bit. How short is your hair? Take your hat off. Yeah. I would never wear a sweater like that. A little bit. Yeah, I guess it's kind of easy to look like me. Just pack on like 400 pounds, grow a beard.
Okay.
But can you do this? No? Fuck. Because I was hoping to go out and get a cigarette. I figured you could come up here and take over since we look so much alike. Is that it?
Oh, yeah. Well, do you want to hang out after? We're all going to be drinking some beer and, you know, smoking some tobacco.
Like, fuck no. 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 After the show, I go home and go to sleep. Why?
We're going to be having fun. You know, I can give you our phone number after if you want it.
So. All right. Stick around, dude.
Okay, thanks.
Wait a second. Why? Oh. Like, am I supposed to, like, get stoned, fuck a sheep, something like that?
I just pretty much wanted to thank you for coming here tonight. I got fired from my job tonight, so I could come here.
Get out of here.
No, I'm dead serious.
What a waste of time. What, where did you work?
It's an Italian restaurant. I was busing.
Really?
Yeah.
Want me to call your boss and smooth things
over? Yeah, if you don't mind. I can get you the phone number.
All right.
Okay.
Write it down. Just bring it up.
Okay. Yeah.
This is Kevin Smith. Who? Silent Bob, man. Who?
What's his number? That's the area code?
Yeah. 93. That's for Tara should be working.
You get him, on the phone, and okay. I'll talk to him.
Go.
I'd like to help when I can.
Amy, hey, this is Matt. Is Tara or Teresa still there?
Okay.
I don't know. They'll say, yeah, Tara, sure, they'll say. Matt.
Matt.
Brown.
If this works, I want 10%.
All right.
Hey, Tara, this is Kevin Smith. I'm here with, what's his name?
Matt Brown.
Matt Brown?
Brown? Yeah.
A dude who used to work there until tonight? He wanted me to talk to you and smooth things over. He's at where he's in a room with about 3,200 people. Sorry. And he said that he had to, what, you quit or get fired?
Well, I kind of got fired, kind of quit.
He said his job might be in jeopardy because he came here tonight and he wanted me to ask you if you could keep him on. No? They're turning on you, Tara. Are you sure? Thank you.
No.
I have no juice whatsoever.
We're all very proud to have Kevin here as part of the Clark community.
I ignored my Jewish duty to be here tonight.
I'm a huge fan of Kevin Smith and all his films and his comic books that he's written with Green Arrow and Daredevil.
I remember reading on your website a little while back how you had just finished Jersey Girl and it was, I want to say, 184 pages.
Mm-hmm.
And how you were thinking of doing that maybe with Affleck, but I remember he was doing Daredevil and there was some stuff going on, so...
There was static.
There we go. I was just wondering if you could tell me about it?
Elaborate on that?
If you could.
I think you had all the details.
Oh, okay.
Back in... on the 4th of July, I went to... I was still out in Los Angeles working on Jane Bob, and we went to Affleck's house for 4th of July. So we were there, and he's a big fan of Chasing Amy, still is kind of this day, like playing the Holden part. And he's always bugging me to write something like that again. He's like, just write something like Chase Amy again. You gotta write it. Who else could write? You gotta write it. Write it, man. Write it. Fuck, write it. And I'm just like, motherfucker, one of us won an Oscar for writing. So I started telling him about this idea that I had for a movie which would eventually become Jersey Girl. He's like, I love it, write it. And I said, I will. When do you want to do it? And he said, April. I want to shoot in April. I got a window in April. I said, yeah, all right, April's good, because it was July and we had a few months. So I'd written about 30, 40 pages, and I sent them off to him, and he fell in love with it, because I'm kind of like a pusher. You know, the first taste is free. And then you have to pay for the rest. And how he pays is we make him work very, very cheap. This dude earns like $15 million a picture, but we bring him on and pay him about $15 an hour. Around the same time, while we're still working on the flick, there's a dude named Mark Steven Johnson who's directing the Daredevil movie. And I had, he'd been hanging around the set while we were shooting the movie. I met him through this other guy, Jim McLaughlin. He said, who do you think could play Daredevil? And I said, Affleck, because that's my answer for everything. Like, I just think Affleck could play. I'm a big fan, so I think he can play anything. People are like, Jaws 5. I'm like, Affleck. Affleck plays the fucking shark. So I was like, Affleck. He's like, Affleck, you really think so? I said, yeah, I think he'd be great. He'd dye his hair red, because Matt Murdock, the guy who is Daredevil in the comics, read it. I said, I think he'd be great. And plus, I know he's a fan, because he wrote the intro to the Daredevil trade paperback I did.
So I told Affleck, I was like, this dude's sniffing around about Daredevil. We'll see if you want to play. He's like, Daredevil, I fucking love Daredevil. I said, that's what I told him. He said, what'd you say? I said, you should play it. He said, why? I was like, I think you should play everything. Like, even the shark from Jaws? Yes, the shark from Jaws. So they hooked up, and they kind of dug each other, and soon Affleck dropped me a call and was just like, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do Daredevil. I'm going to put on the fucking red tights and throw to Billy Club and have the horns. I was like, couldn't be any fucking more embarrassing than Pearl Harbor. Go ahead. I said, when are you going to start? He goes, April. And I said, April, that's when we're going to do Jersey Girl. And he said, yeah, but we can wait on Jersey Girl. You know, we just move it into the summer. I do Daredevil. I'll get paid my big nut. And then we go do Jersey Girl, and you pay me $15 an hour. I said, I don't know, man. I think we should kind of do Jersey Girl first. You said you were going to do it first. And he's like, well, don't get upset. I said, I'm not upset, but fair is fair. And he's just like, you recommended me for fucking Daredevil. I said, I didn't know it was going to coincide with our Jersey Girl shoot. Fuck Daredevil. Because I'll turn coat real quickly. At this point, I haven't even written more than 40 pages of the script, but I'm insisting that we're going to go in April, even though I'm not even nearly done. So finally, 2 weeks go by, and he calls me up, because I let word leak out through our Miramax exec that we were going to go in April no matter what, with or without Ben, even if it was somebody else. So he calls up, and he's just like, what the fuck is this out here? You're going to shoot Jersey Girl with somebody else? You're writing that movie for me. I said, but you're going to put on the tights, so fuck you. But he said, how are we going to work this out? I said, we're not. I'm going to go forward in April, and if you're there, if you want to do it, that's great. If you don't, no hard feelings, go do Daredevil. But I want to do something in April. I want to do this movie. I kind of got into the notion of doing it. And he said, Jesus Christ. He's like, look, if you're telling me that you want me to do Jersey Girl in April and you want me to pass on Daredevil, I'll do it. I won't be happy about it, but I'll fucking do it. And I was just like, well, if we move the movie to the summer, you have to promise to take far, far less than you normally take. And he was just like, oh, God, fine, dude. If that'll do it, he's like, that's great. I said, excellent, and that means a lot to me. And then there's a long pause on the phone. And he's putting shit together in his mind. And then he goes, you didn't even finish writing the fucking script yet, did you? And I said, nope, sucker, goodbye.
Questions.
I really like Mallrat. He uses a large vocabulary and manages to get the upsetting in there too.
When we called up the student activity board, we said we're going to be shooting at Kent State. They were like, bullshit. They're like, we went through that shit once before, never again. That's a tough thing, man. It's just like, that'll always be associated with the school. We'll never live it down, you know, the shooting. I mean, it's a horrible thing, but it's kind of like Germany. Not really. Like, Kent State's not like Germany, but I remember I went to Germany with one of the flicks once, and, you know, they're really nice people. But when you get there, the first thing you're like, where's the concentration camps? Can we... My friends and I would like to go see the concentration camps where you slaughtered many people. Where? And they're like, oh, well, they're here, but, you know, we're Germans and we make cars and culture, beer. I'm sure you like beer. Wouldn't you like to see any of that? And we're like, no, just the concentration camps. We want to see the biggest colossal blunder of any culture anywhere. Take us. They're like, all right, get in the fucking car. And there's always an older person that, like, the cab driver. Speak very broken English. And you're like, so what, were you there? Were you around? Dude's like 26. And he's like, no, you know, but my grandparents were, I guess. They were alive during that time. Like, well, did they know? Did you, were they in trouble? Tell us what more. And the guy's just like, he's heard it a zillion times. And he's like, yeah, well, they teach it in school. And then we go home and we accuse our grandparents of atrocities. But I think that's what he said, because I can't understand German. I'm sure he was just like, shut the fuck up, fat American.
But yeah, I guess that's a tough thing to live down. I'm sure like one day somebody from Kent State will cure cancer. And it'll be like, at Kent State we cured cancer. And they'll be like, yeah, but didn't you have those shootings there?
I'm hoping for mass carnage and orgies and chaos.
It's going to be weird to hear him talk for more than like 2 seconds at a time.
Every time he doesn't say much in the movie, but every time he does say something, everybody turns and looks.
There are definitely some questions I'd like to ask.
Gotta love the dialogue in Clerks.
All rats, much better. Just more lowbrow humor. That's what I love.
Third nipple is awesome.
You can fart jokes.
I don't know. I hope Jay shows up. They do some crazy stuff, man.
I was supposed to have somebody with me here today. However, fucking moron, Mrs. Plain. But I brought the phone so we could call him. Bear with me. How much did you guys pay for this?
Hello.
Hold on. I'm in fucking Wyoming.
What you doing?
See it. It's desolate.
What's up?
I'm driving out of here. There's nobody on the road. It was like the opening of Mallrats. Nobody.
That's why you go.
I'm going to put you on. I'm going to count to three. You say, hello, Wyoming. Ready? One, two, three.
What up, Wyoming?
No, don't cheer too loud. He was just fucking playing. I would like you to explain to these good people why you're not here. Okay? On the count of three. One, two, three.
I missed the plane, man. I overslept. I was getting ahead.
Well, you're not supposed to... Somebody just called you a fucking asshole. Kick his ass, dude. You can't miss shit like this, dude. When they put Jay and Silent Bob on the marquee, you have to show up. It's irresponsible. It's the kind of thing we fire people for.
Who called me the asshole?
That dude over there called you the asshole.
What's up, bro? What's up?
So that was our little bit for the evening. You can see we're such great actors, they gave us our own movie once. And that'll never happen again.
My name is Aaron Guy.
Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm good.
We're good.
I'm very well, thank you.
Okay, I have two questions.
Yes.
One, how did you come up with the characters Jay and Silent Bob?
Yes.
And two, are either of you guys married?
To each other? Because it feels like it. How did I come up with the characters of Jay and Silent Bob? Really, it kind of came from Muse. Growing up, watching Muse grow up. Rather, all right, chill the fuck out. Get the microphone. Come on now. You can be on camera. Don't, like, sit pussy back and be like, what are you? Yeah! So basically, the character of Jay and Silent Bob came from kind of knowing Jason Mewes. When I went off to film school in Canada, I said, I'm going to come back and I'm going to make a movie and put you in it. And he was like, all right. At that point, he was straight edge. He used to wear a black X on his hand. And he was just like, nope. Exactly this. No booze, no drugs, no cigarettes, no women. The women thing kind of confused me a lot, because I was straight edge. I understand it was very like no booze, no drugs, no cigarettes, but most straight edge people fucked, except for this straight edge guy. And since he didn't fuck a lot at that point, he was just like, well, no, they're no good either. Because he wasn't getting laid. But he was the kind of dude that would talk about pussy incessantly, all the time. Like, I'm going to get that fucking pussy, I'm going to lick him, I'm going to stick it, I'm going to do this with that. But you look at him and you're just like, you haven't seen pussy since you were born. And you could always tell because he talked a good game, but as soon as a girl came in the near vicinity, he'd fucking clam up. And he'd get on his stone face, like his stone cold, I am Muse, very cool face. So he'd be like, I'm going to lick that pussy, I'm going to fucking, and the girl would be coming over here, he's like, I'm going to lick. And this used to be, he doesn't do it so much anymore, this used to be his fucking cool face. Like with the eyes affixed to whoever he was studying. But like looking this way and they were that way. It was a real peripheral thing. And then the girl would kind of walk past and be like... And then the moment she was out of this peripheral and earshot, he'd be like, I'm going to lick that fucking pussy. So he talked a good game, and then I left for Vancouver, and I came back. I dropped out after 4 months, but I was gone for a total of 6 months. But by the time I came back from Vancouver, he was completely debauched. Like, you know, the straight X was long gone, and the whole no women thing was also long gone. And if he had a belt that was notched, it would be like the fucking Chewbacca belt around his body. Because he's kind of like the Wilt Chamberlain of indie film. Like, he's fucked a lot. Right? So when I came back, he was a little different than he was when I left, but I wrote the part based on who he was when I left, who he was when he was younger. Like the weird little sonic boom with dirt on it. Thanks.
So how long have you guys known each other? Obviously for a long time, but I don't follow up. I'm not like a connoisseur, but I love your guys' movies and everything. And but no, okay, I'm digging a hole here. So
this is deep.
It's like 13 years.
Yeah. You don't have to be a connoisseur to know that, though. About 13 years, I met him through my friends Brian and Walter at the rec center. I worked at the rec center with Brian and Walter for about a year, and then I left. And then they started telling me all these stories about Jason Mewes, who everybody kind of knew but didn't know. Like, he was younger than us, but you knew him because you saw him in town. He was the town's kid. The kid of urban legend or suburban legend, as the case may be. Like, there's the Mewes kid. He's the one that broke the fucking window at Katz's. Where's the Mewes kid? I hear he fucked a dog. Did you really fuck a dog?
Only once.
I didn't know him, and Brian and Walter would tell me stories about him and shit, and they're like, he's so funny, he says all these funny things, and he's really fucking weird and funny. He's funny. I didn't like that, because I was their new funny friend, so I was kind of territorial about it. And we used to go to comic book shows all the time, and I would drive up to the city because the other two were too pussy to get in the car and drive to the city. So one day Brian and Walter showed up with Mewes, and they're like, well, I was like, what the fuck is this? What's with the kid? What are you babysitting? And they said, we're going to bring him to the city. It'd be funny. Take him, he loves comics. Take him to a comic book show. Make fun of the people there. Not us. And I said, well, I'm not transporting a minor across state fucking lines because the comic book show is in New York. And Brian was like, well, fuck it, I'll drive then. And Mewes is the kind of asshole that's like, shotgun. So he jumps in the front of Brian's car, and I'm crammed in the fucking back seat of Brian. What was it, a Firebird?
Yeah.
With my feet up to my knees up to my fucking ears and shit. And he's in the front, no! Snoogans. And Brian and Walter are like, ah! And I'm in the back like, he ain't so fucking funny. But eventually, Brian and Walter lost interest in him, and he started coming over to my place and knock on the door and shut. And I'd go out and be like, "What?" And he'd be like, "What, you want to do something today?" And I was like, "No." I said, "Look, we share friends, but we're not friends. Like, I am friends with Brian Walter. You are friends with Brian Walter. We don't hang out. I know you live around the block. That's cool, but we don't really hang out." And he's like, all right. So what do you want to do?" So I said, "Look, if you really want to hang out, you come with me to the store, quick stop, 5:30 Sunday morning, we'll make papers." You ever make papers? You know what that is? Paper, newspapers, the Sunday newspapers come in like 5 different sections. You have to put them together. We had 5 Sunday papers, which was a lot of fucking papers put together. You got 200 of each, so you're just doing this for fucking hours upon end. It's terrible, isn't it? This one's not much better. And And Brian and Walter, I'd ask them to go all the time. They're like, "Fuck you." Because I'm like, 5:30 Sunday morning, it'll be fun. I'm like, "No." But Muse, I was like, "Yo, you want to hang out? You do that. Come down to the store, we'll make papers. I'll give you $2. And he was like, "All right." So he would come down and we'd make papers together. And some of them we would stack on the ice cream case, you know, that Dante and Randall are sitting on in Clerks when he's doing the salsa shark. We'd stack the papers there, and Muse would go to sleep behind the papers on the freezer case. And Muse is a horrible fucking sleeper. When he sleeps, he drools like a child. So there would be this dude sleeping with his mouth wide open, tons of fucking liquid pouring out onto the freezer case and freezing. So he had like this icicle thing going on. And then people would come and get papers, and as the piles got lower and lower, sooner or later, he would show up. So somebody would be like, "Oh, what the fuck?" You know? But we started hanging out that way and kind of bonded that way. But the day that I realized he was a comedic genius without knowing it, and hopefully he still doesn't know it, was the day that Walter and I were sitting in the recreation center. We'd picked up comics. The kids hadn't come from school yet. And we were sitting in the library. It's all quiet. And the door fucking gets kicked open, and Muse marches in like Groucho Marx and proceeds to fillet anything somewhat phallic in the room. So if there's a pool cue, he's sucking it off. Grabs the phone receiver, sucking it off. Grabs the flag, takes a little legal off the top, he's sucking it off. Everything, going, sucking everything in the room off. And Walter and I are watching him go, just like... And the dude never once looked at us for approval. Like, "Look at this, it's funny, isn't it? I'm sucking everything off." Almost like he didn't know we were there or didn't care. Like, he had an agenda, you know? I always pictured him as, like, walking around town going, like, "It's 2:30. I better go to the rec and suck everything off." So he does this for about 15 minutes, uninterrupted, and then reaches, we had a standing asteroids machine, which, if you remember, doesn't have a joystick, it has a rollerball, and he fucking stops dead, because there's no joystick. And me and Walter are like, you know, because what's a guy to do? He ran out of phallic symbols, and he fucking shrugged, and he went down on the rollerball. I said, "This is the dude I want to hang out with forever. Because A, he's pretty funny. B, he looks like he sucks a lot of dick. And for them slow nights, that's a good guy to have around." It's like, no chicks. We went and saw the movies. "Want to suck my dick?" "All right, moves." So we've been hanging out for 13 years.
Cool.
Okay.
Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having.
In the comics and the movies... does Jay's tiny dick and latent homosexuality come from his escapades at the rec center? Or is there something else behind that?
He's talking about you, though. You're writing this shit, though.
Yeah.
What are you writing about?
So I should answer?
Yeah.
Why don't you answer?
What?
Is any of it true?
Well, are you asking him about a small dick? I don't know about my dick. I don't know if it's small. I know it's not big, though. But,
you got like 1,000 judges here, dude. Whip it out.
I'm not...
They'll let
I'm
you
not
know.
I'm gay, though. No, I love pussy. I love pussy. So much.
The dude...
I've seen the proof.
Who, him, me, or him?
Let me turn up me. No, I like the cock in my mouth. Won't you put a cock in your mouth and shut your face?
You just got unleashed there for a second. You're like, put a fucking cock in your mouth and shut your face.
Jay and Silent Bob, such a great chemistry in the movies, great sexual tension, if you will.
Yes.
How come in the last one they never got it on? I was disappointed a lot.
How come the last one they didn't just fuck?
Yeah.
Wait till DVD.
Thank you. Your final project, Jay and Silent Bob porn, whole movie.
Jay and Silent Bob porn.
Yeah.
Believe me, there are days when I'm afraid that will become true. Because Muse isn't the most discerning actor on the planet. He was hanging out with this dude named Johnny Nitro, I think. Guy makes porn. And he was like, I went to the set of a porn. And I was like, that's really cool. What was that like? And he was just like, it was kind of cool. You know, they were sitting around fucking, and then they asked me if I wanted to get in, and so I was getting into it. I was like, what? Wait, what? What? It was like it was a courtroom scene, and like they asked me if I wanted to sit in the jury, and I was like, you didn't do it, did you? And he was like, no. I was like, all right, just as long as it's no. So periodically, I cruise the porn aisle to make sure Muse isn't in any of the movies. Just for that, you know. But no Jay and Bob porn in the future. There is a Jay porn that exists. Without Silent Bob, but Silent Bob watched it.
Can I get a copy?
Can you get a copy of it?
Yeah.
Not tonight, because I don't have it on me. But I'll try to make it publicly available. Because we sell everything else on that fucking website of ours.
Yeah.
www.bursq.com. You like Jay, dude?
Yeah. Is he single?
Yeah. In as much as, like, he's tied to no one person.
So there's a chance.
There's always a chance, my friend.
Thank you.
Okay. Hey, Kevin.
Wait. You saying you're into Muse? You owe me for that tremendous setup, sir. Would you like to hear a story about how he almost got married? You gotta ask him one day, it's pretty funny. Muse had a girlfriend for a long time. And one day, I don't want to say her name because he's no longer with her. One day we were going to the mall, and he goes, so I did it last night. I asked, and fuck it, her name's Jamie. I asked Jamie to marry me. And I said, really? He's like, yeah, I did. I kind of did it all cool, too. I, like, got... He has this fish tank. He's like, I gave her these fish. I got her these special expensive fish. And then I put the ring in this box at the bottom of the fish tank. You know, bubbles, little treasure chest, and it opens. And so, you know, I gave it to her. She came in, and I was like, look at the fish. And then she, you know, did, and she saw the ring, and I got down on one knee and proposed. I was like, that is really fucking cool, man. Like, I'm shocked. You? I was like, that's really fucking sweet, man. I wish I'd been there for that. I wish you would have told me about it. It would have been nice to be a fly on the wall for that. He's like, well, I taped it. I was like, you did? He's like, yeah, I set up a tape recorder in the corner of the room, hung it up, and turned it on when I knew she was coming, and then she pulled up, and then she was talking to my mom for a little bit out in the living room for like a half hour, and I was getting pissed, and I wasn't going to propose to her anymore, because she was making me wait.
you know, the exact mind frame you want to enter into marriage with. He's like, but then she came in and we went through it and it's all on tape. I said, that's brilliant, man. I would like to see that. You got to give me the tape. He's like, I will. And he's all quiet for a few minutes. He's like, there's another tape too. And I was like, really? What are you doing that one? He's like, we fuck. And I was like, get the fuck out of here, really? He was like, yeah, you know, we were celebrating. We got engaged, so I changed the tape, and then we just started going at it. And I said, I got to see that one, too. And he's like, you want to see it? I was like, shit, yes, of course. Give me the tape. So he gave me both. He gave me the wedding, the engagement tape and the Jason Mewes fuck tape. I took him home, and I threw the wedding tape aside. So he told me about it. Fuck it. I want to see this man in action. And I put in the tape, and it's one of the worst amateur porns you've ever seen. You know, it's a real one camera setup. It's like Clerks, but even funnier. Sets up the camera, and the MTV Video Music Awards is playing in the background. Whole time. Now, across from them in the frame is a picture, a framed poster of the X-Men. The comic book version. And in the reflection of the X-Men is the Video Music Awards. So the camera, the whole time, is auto-focusing between Jay and Jamie and the Video Music Awards. So number one, it's the most irritating porn in the world to watch. Because you're like... Number two, he pretty much gets in there and blocks the whole thing. So you're not really seeing anything good. Just his ass up and down, up and down. And I've seen that a zillion fucking times. But the best part about it was what I told him when I saw it later, because he wanted me to critique it. So I sat him down and I was like, I'm the last guy that should be telling you this, but you got to work on your camera work. But number two, I got to talk to you about your whole finale. And he's like, what about it? And I'm just like, well, dude, it's this weak sauce. And he's like, what do you mean? I was like, this is you. And he starts fucking cracking up. He's guffawing. Like, when he really starts laughing, he's like, ha! And his veins pop out. I'm like, I'm serious, dude. It's just like you fucking give three thrusts, one tug, and you walk away. Try a little tenderness, you know? A cuddle, something. I was like, and it went on forever. At a certain point, I just stopped watching and concentrated on the VMAs because it was on in the background. But he said he promised to work on his technique. And I've yet to see the follow-up. But now that I know you're available, that's the one I would like to see. Because I've seen him fuck a chick and I wasn't impressed.
My name is Abe Mohamedion. I got a question about you and Scott Mosier.
Yes.
What's a little history about your relationship, where you met him, and the dynamic that's followed through with the five movies?
My history with Mosier. I went to Vancouver Film School in British Columbia because it was a quick tech program. It was 8 months, $9,000 for 8 months. And at the end, they don't give you a degree, you get a certificate that says essentially you finished this program, which is about as useful as a degree, you'll find out. So while I was there, I was there for 4 months and then dropped out and went back to Jersey because I went for hands-on technical stuff. They were like, it's all practice, all practical, no theory. And then we got there and did theory for about 2-3 months. So I said, fuck it, I don't need some Canadian dude telling me what Demi was trying to say with Silence of the Lambs, you know. So I stuck around for a little bit, but during that time, I met Mosier. Mosier, the first day that I went to class, and we had one class, 25 people, and we, you know, went through every class together. They do it, they bring in a new bunch, I think, every 4 months or something like that. So Mosier was a guy in a class that I was like, look at this motherfucker, he's a pretty boy. Because he had like this real 90210 dude going on. He had a real Luke Perry thing going on. And he came in a leather jacket, like a motorcycle hood. But like a good-looking motorcycle hood, like the motorcycle hood with a heart of gold.
whose mom died. And he's just really misunderstood. And he'll probably hook up with Brenda before the season's out. That was my first take on Mosier. And Mosier said that his first take on me was like, look at the blowhard asshole. So we didn't really like each other, didn't speak for a while, and then we kind of got thrown together on this project. And turns out we had a similar sense of humor. And we joked about calling our production company for this little project post-party at Spago's. And we both got it, and nobody else in class did. So I was like, all right, I want to hang out with this guy because he gets the obscure bad references. And we just started hanging out more and more. And that's kind of where our friendship built. And when I left, when I told him, I was like, I'm not going to stick around here. Because I think if I get out now before the four-month mark, I get to walk with $5,000 out of the tuition. So I said, I'm going to take my $5,000 and go put it in a movie. And I said, I'm going to go home and start writing. But he wanted to stay and finish the course because his parents would be proud and shit like that. I didn't care about my parents. My parents were like, look, we know that you're a failure. If you drop out, it's fine. So I did. But I said, I'm going to go home and write. And when you get out, you write. And whoever gets done with the script first, the other will go and help the other one out. If you finish your script, I'll go up to Vancouver. We'll help you make your movie. If I finish mine, you come down and help me make mine. So I finished Clerks first, and he came down and kind of got trapped into the role of the de facto producer. You know, because nobody really goes to film school going like, I want to produce. You know, like everyone wants to be a filmmaker. My job is kind of the dream job. Like I get to write, you know, fucking Jay and Silent Bob run into a wall. You know, and then I hand it to him. I'm like, figure it out. And he's like, all right, well, it's going to cost about this much, and we have to hire this many people, and blah, blah, blah. So his job is the tough job, particularly on Chasing Amy. His head almost fucking exploded because we were trying to make that movie for $200,000, $250,000, actually. And initially, we wanted to do it for $3 million. We had done we'd done Mallrats for $6 million. First one was $28,000. Second one, Mallrats, was $6 million. So we were like, we'll drop down and go to a sensible budget. Sensible budget would have been $3 million at that point. But we pitched the movie to Miramax, gave them the script, and they're like, this is great. Who do you want to put in it? And I was like, I wrote it for three friends of mine, Ben Affleck, Jason Lee, Joey Lauren Adams. And the exec at Miramax was like, oh, no, we can't go that way. We have to put celebrities in it. We were thinking like Drew Barrymore, John Stewart, David Schwimmer. I was like, why? Where'd you get that grouping from? Like, that's real random. Did you just pick those three off the top of your head? But they'd had kind of overall deals with them. So I said, no, but I don't want to do it with them. I want to make it with my people. I wrote it for my people. And the exec said words I will never forget. Kevin, it's not about making a movie with your friends. And I was like, really? Because that's been the whole point of my career. So, I went to see Harvey Weinstein, the chairman, and I said, look, you guys want to do the movie at $3 million with a cast. We don't want to use the cast. I want to use the people I wrote it for. So why don't you let us go off and make the movie for like $200,000, and we'll bring it back. If you like it, buy it. If not, we get to take it someplace else because we have an overall deal with them at this point. And he said, $200,000? I'll give you $250,000. And I said, oh my God, that's really fucking generous. All right, man, yeah, that's cool. So I went home, I told Mosier, I'm like, Harvey gave us the money for the movie. And he's like, get out of here. I said, yeah, man, I asked for one amount, he gave me more. And Mosier's like, that's fucking terrific, man. You're really good at this shit. So what's the budget? And I was like, $250,000. And Mosier was just like, oop. The brain just came out, and he was like, $250,000? What are you, fucking nuts? We can't make a movie for $250,000. I was like, well, we already made a movie for $28,000. He's like, that's barely a movie. He's like, well, we wanted this movie you wrote is a little more complicated than that. How are we going to do it? I was like, I don't know, you'll figure it out. I'm going to call Ben and Jason and tell them the good news. And he was like, good Lord. So he spent most of Chasing Amy, like, sleeping in his office under his desk, trying to figure out where the money was coming from, trying to make everything work on a shoestring and shit like that. Shooting that movie for $250,000 almost killed Mosier. And I never noticed, you know, because my job is kind of always the same, no matter what movie we make or what the budget is. Like, I write it. And then I rehearse the actors and hope that they give the performance on camera that I heard in my head when I was writing it, if not a better performance. So it doesn't matter what the budget is. Like, my job doesn't change, but Mosier's job is always affected by the budget. Like, the last one was $20 million. Jay and Bob Strike Back was $20 million, and he was happy as a pig in shit. Because he was just like, I'm like, hey, they're telling me there's a problem. He's like, that's fine, throw some money at it. Problem solved, you know? But with the other ones, it's like, hey, we got a problem over here. He's like, not my fault, you asked for $200,000, asshole. And I'm like, oh. So he runs the gamut depending on what the budget is. Dogma 2 was kind of a tight stretch because it was a $10 million flick and we probably should have had more to do it. And also we were dealing with crazy fucking hectic schedules of people leaving and coming and going and shit because they were all getting paid scale, which is like minimum wage of the movie business. So that meant we had to allow them to go off and do other things if they wanted to go off and shoot other shit. So that became a nightmare for him. But the last one, like I said, he had a great time doing. He's like, I love making movies with you, but I hate all the shit that I have to go through. I hate dealing with these people. And I'm like, all right, well, we can make movies with puppets. But he's not real, he's afraid of puppets. So he's in this weird headspace where, like, he went out and bought a VW conversion van. And Mosier, you don't know him, so it's not going to play as well as it did for me, but Mosier really doesn't buy extravagant things. He kind of lives a very a monk-like life. So one day I came to the office and I saw this fucking tricked-out conversion van. And I was like, whose piece of shit is that? And he's like, that's mine. And I was like, why? Really? Why'd you get that? He's like, I don't know, $38,000. I figure instead of walking the earth, I can drive the earth. And he took me out there. He's like, here's the sink, and there's a stove in it, and out back there's a little shower thing if I want to shower. And I roll up the top, it's a pop out, and then I got two beds up here, and it's beds down here, and me and Monica could sleep up here. If you come, you and Jen could sleep under us. And I'm like, I'll be up for that. So he's in this weird kind of, I've got a VW conversion van headspace, and I don't know if I want to keep making movies for Miramax, if that makes any sense.
So
we should call him. You know, Mosier first. Hold on. Believe me, I'd much rather call people all night. Just hold the phone to the mic. Hey, Monica. Is Scotty there? Okay. Hey, man. What's up? I'm at Kent State on stage. I'm gonna count to three. I'm gonna put you to the mic and just tell them in like 20 seconds. Give them a rough breakdown of your conversion van. Yeah, like what it's tricked out with. All right, ready? I'm gonna count to three. I'm gonna hold you to the mic. Ready? One, two, three.
It's got a fridge. It's got a two-burner stove, a sink. It can sleep four. It's got the pop-up. Runs off propane, so I can run the thermostat, keep it hot. Make a little love, you know.
Anything else?
Not much more to say than that, man.
Come on, you sold it to me big time.
That's about it, man.
What'd you pay for it?
It costs like about between 35 and 40. Look, I've been working a long time, man.
Alright. What color is it? It's beige? White? No, white. It's white.
The guy in the back went, that's beautiful, man. All
right, man, that's it. All right, bye.
Hi, my name's Sean Johnson. I was just wondering, in your writing, do you take any of your own personal life experiences and put them in?
Yes, there was this one time me and my friends were running from this huge rubber poop monster. We tried to sneak into Miramax Studios, you know. Fell onto the set of Good Will Hunting 2.
No, generally not. Not really, because real life tends to be very boring, right? Which is why the dialogue in the movies that I write tends to be the way it is, because people say, oh, it sounds like you write down the conversations of your friends. It just sounds very natural. And not at all, because the conversations I have with my friends are probably very similar to the conversations you have with your friends, which are just like, what did you do last night? Got laid. Awesome. You know, one word, really monosyllabic caveman type talk. But the writer kind of, I've read somewhere in a book, the writer crafts the ideal world, their ideal world. In my ideal world, everyone has really long conversations about interesting shit, or just picks apart pop culture to death. And everyone talks in monologues. Generally not. I mean, there are definitely instances of real life, and like, I did work at Quick Stop and RST, and that's about where it stops. There were people that would check the date of the milk, but not, you know, like the lady in the movie, who was my mom, incidentally. And there were no people did check the eggs at the counter, something that always bugged me. Bring eggs up to the counter and check them in front of you, as if I'm sitting in the back with a little hammer, like... like, I'll break one and they'll never know. Then you tend to take that shit and kind of blow it out of proportion. That makes it interesting. Because Chasing Amy, if I wrote about real life, Chasing Amy would be all about the fact that I couldn't stand that my girlfriend at the time had went to Bali when she was younger and I didn't. Not a very interesting movie.
Yeah.
So I'm like, well, maybe, you know, her boyfriend suggests they should sleep, you know, with his best friend, and that kind of makes it more interesting. Because shit like that doesn't happen to me in real life. Like, I've never sat around with Scott Mosier and was like, we should fuck my girlfriend. Mosier's like, we're having a real problem with the budget here. I'm like, I know, let's fuck my girlfriend. He's like, I don't know that it'll help, but okay. So you tend to kind of exaggerate a lot of stuff. But, you know, sometimes you start with the kernel of truth. Like Chasing Amy, I was very much like Holden. I was very insecure about girlfriend's past at the time that I wrote that movie. And now, you know, I'm kind of beyond. I'm 31. Now I'm insecure about the grave. You know, I don't care who fucked who. I just don't want to die.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, man.
It seems to me like comedy in general, and especially your kind of witty satire, often stems from like some sort of...
I've never heard it quite described like that.
I apologize. Anyway,
you're kind of witty satire. You're bullshit. Go ahead.
So comedy in general seems to me like it stems from a certain level of frustration in life, and I was wondering if, first of all, if that's true for you, and perhaps if there's a specific area of your life where you were especially frustrated as a child, or when you were younger, I mean. Like, you talk about, yeah, you know, this is for all the girls who said my dick was small or something. Like,
yes.
Is there some area of life that was particularly frustrating and that bleeds into...
Take a fucking guess, dude. I can answer it. I'll put my spin on it. I think I do what I do because I grew up fat. Ooh, the room came down. Don't get all serious on me. It's fucking true. We don't have to, you know, it's not like a life-threatening affliction. It is, but it's not. I think because I grew up a heavy kid, it tended to make me want to be funny. Because, you know, if you can't get over with your looks, like, you don't know what I'm talking about. You're a good-looking man.
That's the first time I've ever heard that.
Really?
Yeah.
What are you doing after the show? If you can't get over like that, and I'm not just talking about getting over on girls, I'm just talking about, like, people generally want to hang out with a certain aesthetic type, people that look quote-unquote normal. When you don't look normal, you tend to be castigated, kind of like, well, that kid's fat, yipes, that kind of thing. So if you have something else going for you, they tend to overlook your physical flaws. That's my theory. That's what I've found in life. So, from you fucking thin people. But, so I think it came from there. I think my comedy comes from that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks for bringing up really painful fucking memories. I think if the room got, you could hear a fucking pin. They're like, holy shit, he's about to cry. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Ben Van Vactor. I'm just curious, what do your parents feel about your films?
My parents, my mother, when she saw Clerks, the first time I sat her down to watch it, and she watched the flick, she turned to me and goes, you spent $27,000 on that piece of garbage? I was like, thanks, Mom, that's real Carol Brady of you. But then she kind of grew to like the movies as they went on. She didn't think much about Mallrats either, but Chasing Amy she really loved and connected to for some reason. Like, I don't know.
like, I'm sitting there watching the movie with her, and A, she's laughing at blowjob jokes. Like, her and my old man are sitting there chuckling at blowjob jokes, and I'm just like, oh, God. She's giving him head. And also at the end of the movie, she was crying, and I was really moved by that. And I was just like, oh, my God, you know, you really got into it. She's like, I think it's beautiful. She's like, I identify with that movie in ways you'll never understand. And I was like, so they've caught on. She really liked Dogma because she's a lifelong Catholic, and it addressed a lot of issues that she has as well, but would never voice for fear of going straight to hell, which she maintains is where I'm going. Jane Bob, she thought was really cute. That's what she said. She's like, I thought it was really cute. You guys ran around a lot. She's like, was it tough to run around like that? In that long coat? And I felt like I was at a fucking college Q&A. The caliber of that question. I wasn't directed at everybody.
I'm Jenny Shively, and
hey.
Okay, first of all, I really like Dogma.
Thank you.
And I was wondering, A, it's two parts, okay?
Okay.
A, do you believe in God?
Yes.
And B, why or why not? So
yes.
Why?
Oh.
Why?
Yes, I believe in God. Why? Because I have a career. There can be no better explanation or proof for the existence of God than the fact that I have a film career.
All right.
I think so.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hi.
Where's the camera? There's no camera on you.
I don't know. That's okay.
Somebody is sending you a very clear message, sir.
My name is David Klesch, and I was just wondering if you could talk about the effect of your Catholic upbringing in your movies, specifically Dogma.
I would imagine that watching Dogma, that would be very, very clear. But since you asked, I grew up very Catholic. I went to 8 years of Catholic school. But I really dug the faith when I was a kid, and then as I got older, started struggling with it, as most people do. And was just like, wait a second, like I appreciate the message, and I appreciate who Christ was and what Christ did, but I'm not really into the dogma. I want to fuck before I get married. But it stretched beyond that. I think by the time I started really questioning, I was about 18, 19. And I started wondering, like, wait a second, like, you know, we hold the book, the Bible, to be like the Word of God. And meanwhile, you know, many, many years ago, a bunch of Grecians and Egyptians held their books to be the Word of gods. And now we read their shit as literature and chuckle at silly stories. And will someone one day read our books and chuckle at silly stories? And if that's the case, then is there a God? Did we just create God? Did somebody create God so that I would quit asking questions and things like that? And went through a real crisis of faith. And worked through it years later by working on Dogma, by writing Dogma. And that's kind of where the idea came from, the crisis of faith. And then by the end of writing the first draft of Dogma, I was like, no, I know exactly where I stand on religion. I believe in faith. I believe in God. I believe in Christ. I'm a Christian. I'm a really spiritual person, but religion gets a lot of people in a lot of trouble. Because when we were making that movie, when we were making it, it was fine. But when we were working on post-production, getting ready to put that movie out, it was fucking nuts. Like, we got death threats. We had 300,000 pieces of hate mail and 3 death threats. Or 2. 2.5 death threats. Because I think one recanted toward the end. I'm going to fucking kill you. Well, maybe not. But there's one that I will never forget, and I will take it with me to my grave, and not the actual missive, but what it said. And I read it so many times. I've read it to people so many times that I committed it to memory. And it said, "You Jews better take that money you stole from us and start investing in flak jackets, because we're coming in there with shotguns. Your brothers in Christ, dot, dot, dot."
And the Jews in question, of course, were Harvey and Bob Weinstein, the guys that run Miramax and Dimension, who were originally putting out the flick. See, they got it the worst, right? Like, I was Catholic, so people would just be like, you ought to know better, but your Jew buddies, they're going to pay. And, you know, you don't want to point out that Christ was Jewish, because these people tend to forget that. Jewish? No, he's a wasp. But it was insane. They had to open our mail for a while. We had to stop receiving mail at the office. They had to have a service open it. We couldn't receive packages for a year. When we went to Cannes, they wanted to put up metal detectors, and the Palais wouldn't let them put up metal detectors, so instead Miramax hired bodyguards for people, armed bodyguards. It was really kind of a kooky time. And the whole time I'm just like, it's a movie with a fucking rubber poop monster in it. Take it easy. But people kind of, you know, they judge it, of course, without seeing it. And if they had seen it, the people, mostly the people who were attacking the movie, would never see it. They never bothered to see it. But if they had taken the time to actually watch the movie, they would have been like, we'd be really stupid to go after this movie because it's not a threat to anybody. There is a rubber poop monster up there on the screen. Kid was right. But they didn't, so, you know, we were the way for that group, the particular group that went after us, the Catholic League, to go after Disney and Miramax, who were the original distributors of the movie. They go after them all the time. They tend to go after Disney quite a bit. Because if you go after Disney, you get a lot of press, a lot of coverage, just particularly if you're charging Disney with stuff like being anti-Catholic. Because the weird thing is when Harvey and Bob Weinstein bought the movie away from Miramax and then resold it to Lionsgate, the eventual theatrical distributors of the movie, the Catholic League just went away. You know, they made so much noise about, like, we're going to take this movie down and it will never be seen and we must stop it because it is a true affront to all Catholics and God hates it and blah, blah, blah. And then when Lionsgate picked it up, they were just like, we won. And we were like, how do you win? The movie's still coming out. And they were like, yeah, but Disney's not distributing it. But I was always very curious about the protesters and whatnot, so when the movie came out, I got involved. So I read in the Asbury Park Press that there was going to be a protest at our local theater in Eatontown, the Sony Multiplex. So I said, holy shit, I want to go, because I read there was going to be 1,500 people there. That's 1,500 people from my neck of the woods. I'm bound to know some of them because I went to church with them. My mom might be one of them. So I want to go. And I said to the wife, I was like, let's go to the protest. And she was like, you're fucking nuts. I said, no, we should go. It'll be fun. And she said, I don't know. I said, we'll call Brian, my friend Brian Johnson. I said, we'll call Brian. Brian will go too. And so I called up Brian. I was like, Brian, you want to go protest the movie? And he's like, I've been dying to do that for months. So Brian came over and we grabbed some construction paper, like cardboard paper, like, you know, those big pieces. We got magic markers and glue and sparklies and we made signs. So we're working on our signs and working on them really well, right, because we want to blend in. And one of them said, dogma is dog shit. And the other one said, to hell with dogma. And both of us are really, like, taking our time, just, like, not going outside the lines. And, is this done? No, a little glitter. You know, really went all out. And then drove over to the multiplex. So we get there, and the 1,500 is about 15, period. And I see a small smattering of people standing at the head of the driveway, very far from the theater. I'm like, wow, that looks kind of weird. I wonder what those people, they must be watching the protest. And we pull up, and that is the protest. So we got out with our signs, and Brian and I are the youngest people there by about 50 years. So it's a bunch of, you know, 65-year-old people and maybe some 50-year-olds. And they're all praying the rosary, and they have a very large crucifix standing there with our Lord in his usual pose. So So they got the crucifix, and they were all reciting the rosary, which I know very well because I've gone to Catholic school for many, many years. And Brian didn't, so I said, just jump in line, follow after me. And I'm like, Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. And Brian's just like, oh, son, Lord, Jesus, Joseph. I'm like, he's not in the Our Father. So we're standing there holding our signs, reciting the rosary, and we notice that nobody really has any signs, at least none that are nearly as nice as ours. There's a dude standing next to me who has a sign that looks like it was torn out of the bottom of a cardboard box, like just kind of cut out, and it said, dogma is bad. And it looked like he wrote it in his car with a pen that he had in his glove compartment. No glue, no sparklies. Not a streamer in sight. Really, just no effort whatsoever. And he's standing next to me, and I've got my sign. Like, he's holding the signs about this big. And I'm holding mine like this. It's like a sandwich board. And we're doing the Our Father, and he's holding his. I'm standing next to him. He's like, Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. The King of Kings. We've done our things. He's having a kiss. Because he put his sign down, right? Because he was so embarrassed that mine was that great. And a lady who was about three or four people over had seen our signs, I guess, had looked at either when we were joining the line or when we had joined the line already. And she came over while we're praying, and she's like, you can't have that here. I said, why? And she's like, you can't say that kind of thing here. Like, you know, because she was pointing to dogma as dog shit. And she's like, you got to get rid of that. And I'm like, no, but I mean, I want to protest this movie. And she's like, but you can't say that kind of, we don't need that kind of help. We don't want to say those kinds of things. I was like, but it's true. The movie is. And she said, well, just take the word off. Take that one, the offensive word off. And I said, but that just says dogma's dog. So she said, well, just take off the two letters. I said, so dogma, all right. And I bend it up. And so now it says dogma's dog, shh. And she goes back to her place. About 15 minutes into maybe the fourth, we're into the fourth decade. News van pulls up. I'm not lying. News van pulls up, Channel 12 News, local in our area. So I'm standing there and I'm just kind of looking at them and thinking, this would be interesting. I think about Bolton, I was like, fuck it, they'll never know. These people don't know, they'll never know. And a lady gets out, journalist, kind of well dressed. And she got a clipboard under her arm. And all of a sudden, she kind of looks in my general direction. She goes back to looking around, and she comes back. And she looks at her clipboard. So she comes over. And Brian's like, holy shit. So the lady comes over, and she's looking at her clipboard right in my face and looking at me, and she's like, are you him? And I was like, no, that's him. You know, because our Lord was there. And she goes, no, are you him? Are you the guy? I said, oh, no, but I get that all the time. And she was like, would you mind if I interviewed you? And I said, yo, please. Because I'm a press whore, so even, you know, if I'm incognito, I'm still happy to give an interview. So she calls the camera guy over, and he starts shooting, and she's just like, so what are you doing here tonight? And I was like, we're here to protest this movie. And she said, okay, have you seen it? And I said, no. You know, because I wanted to be in character. I said, no, but they tell me it's really, really bad. And she's like, right. She's like, have you seen anything else made by the filmmaker? I said, no. Well, I saw Clerks. That was really funny. But... said, "But I'm not gonna watch anything else. I'm certainly not gonna watch this." And she's like, "All right, what's your name?" And I was like, "Brian Johnson." You know, and Brian's like, "Oh shit." And she goes, "Do you have ID?" And I said, "Yeah." And she's like, "Can I see it?" I was like, it's in my wallet." And I didn't bring my wallet. And she's like, "Why not?" And I was like, "Well, look at these people." So she took off. And she's shooting the rest of the line, and she's still shooting me, and she's still whispering to the camera guy, and Johnson's like, "We should really go now." And finally, they took off, and then that night on the Channel 12 news, sure enough, Brian Johnson was talking about how bad Dogma was. And my mother called me and was like, "There's somebody on TV looks just like you." That's a very long answer. It has nothing to do with your question. I'm working from pre-programmed bits.
Hi, I'm Raquel Reinstein.
Hi.
And my question is, are you ever thinking of making a science fiction film?
Or? A science fiction movie. I don't know. I think I have made one already. Chasing Amy. Because you go ask any lesbian, that'll never happen. Even if, and probably especially because, the dude is Ben fucking Affleck. But no, there is a sci-fi idea in me. I'm just nowhere near doing it yet. And so I don't know, somewhere down the road. Say your name.
My name's Leela.
Leela?
Leela, L-E-L-A.
L-E-L-A.
Before when you said the thing about Chasing Amy and no self-respecting lesbian.
Yes, yes.
I was going to ask you about that because it's kind of ironic that Adrian Rich, who's an amazing poet who wrote the lesbian.
Are you coming out?
they all know me. I'm, anyway.
Are you out?
Yeah.
Calm down. This is college. Y'all act like you've never seen a lesbian before. So the Chasing Amy question was?
Well, I'll rephrase it slightly given what's happened here. Well, I actually really dislike Chasing Amy, even though I loved Clerks, and I've really
Did
liked
you?
your movies a lot.
I think you're done. Next.
Because I did feel like it sort of made the point that all a lesbian needs is a good deep dick.
Did you? It's an excellent point.
But...
No. I'm not saying that is
okay.
An excellent point. It's an excellent point they bring that up. Because I've heard this one. Can I let you go on for like 2 hours. It is like the Kevin Smith show. My feelings on that have been the same since 1996 when I wrote it, all the way up to this very moment when you said that. I don't see how someone can say that. Somebody will say that, like, oh, the film just strengthens the point that all any lesbian needs is one good man to turn around. Is that what you were saying?
Sort of.
Okay, but we have the idiot character in the movie, Banky, say that, hence deflating the argument. Don't you understand? Like, we put those words into the guy who's always wrong in the movie. So when the idiot says that, didn't you get the point that that's what I was saying?
I got that point, but I mean, do you find it at all weird that you speak to audiences who feel pretty much comfortable to yelling, "Show us your tits" to a woman in the crowd?
Very, very uncomfortable.
I mean, well, I think that maybe it wasn't your fault, but I think that movie put that out.
Stop it, this is political. Very uncomfortable, but that has nothing to do with this.
Well,
let's stay on topic.
I think it does. I think I can see, when I first saw the movie, like, I thought it was kind of dumb but harmless. But I saw that the...
Wait. Come on. This is excellent, candid point. I'm just pissed that we didn't know you when we were making the movie, because that would have been excellent for the poster. Tagline, dumb but harmless. Some bi-curious girl from college. You know, that would be cool. Go ahead, finish your point.
Because all I need is a good deep dick in, is that...
Pardon?
Nothing. I was just going to say that I think that obviously you can't control the way people take the movie, but it
yes.
was sort of frustrating to be a young lesbian at that point in the 90s when that film came out.
How old are you?
I'm 22.
That's going back 4 years?
So I was 18. Did you know you were straight when you were 18?
No.
Oh, okay.
Ma'am, I'm still not sure. And I've got a wife and child. How irresponsible is that? All I can do is make movies the way I want to make them, the way I want to see them, as entertaining as possible. And if I can whip a little bit of message in there, that's more than most cats do. And I feel good. I can sleep with myself and a man or woman at night because of that. The movies we've made, there's always been a little bit of gay content in there. Would you agree with that? And although you think it's dumb but harmless, some people have considered it a breakthrough, and boy, that really enabled them to come out and show like that. And people, a large portion of the gay community loves the stuff we do. A very small pocket is just like, he's a bug, closet, gator, blah, blah, blah. Not knowing the amount of cock that I chug myself, but... that's none of their fucking business. But I've always kind of thrown that in there because I always felt, from Clerks forward, even before I knew we were going to have an audience, when I was writing Clerks, I have a brother. My brother's gay. I just outed him to everyone at Cornell. He's very up. My brother and I had a discussion when he first came out, and he was talking about movies, about how weird it is to go to predominantly, 99.9999% hetero movies and watch guy end up with girl, live happily ever after, never see himself represented on the screen in any way, shape, or form, unless it's a very swishy stereotype, i.e. The Birdcage, or a nice pick killer. So I just thought, wow, that's pretty shitty. My brother, can't sit there and get into a flick on any level, because he doesn't feel he's represented. So I said, I'm going to throw a little gay content into flicks so my brother will know that I'm throwing it in there for him. Because, why the fuck not? When we found out we had an audience, or when I found out we had an audience, I said, fuck it, I'm going to start throwing lots of gay content in. Because they're sitting there, right? And yes, they are predominantly kind of young. And I do have fans that are like, great movies, man, want to get high? And I also do have some fans, nobody in this room, mind you, but some fans that are like, love those movies, man, but why is there so much gay stuff in them? Gay's bad, blah, blah, blah. So I've always tried to throw in a little content to kind of fuck with their heads. Case in point was Chasing Amy. We make Chasing Amy, and we have our first test screening, and they keep 10 people around to do a focus group. Ever been to a focus group? Focus group, they keep 10 people around and ask them questions. It's like 200 people, they keep 10 around and they ask them questions afterwards. They're like, what did you like about the movie? What didn't you like about the movie? Tell us why. And then they go into it, and then they take all that data, give it to the filmmaker, and they're like, do it better. Horrible fucking process. But it's interesting to listen to people and what they say. So they talk to one cat in the audience. And he's like, I won't forget this guy, he was precious to me. He's like, look, I like Kevin Smith's movies a lot, because I am a Kevin Smith character. I am Brody. I hang out with them all, I love comics, and I wouldn't fuck Shannon Doherty either. And if you saw this motherfucker, he wouldn't have a chance. But I'm sitting quietly in the back because you're not supposed to reveal yourself because that'll skew the data. So I'm just kind of sitting back there chuckling and listening. And he's like, but I'm watching this movie and I'm identifying with the Banky character because it's Jason Lee again and I dig and I'm with him and suddenly, boom, the dude's gay. What the fuck's that say about me? And from the back, below my chair, I was like, meet your fucking gay! And the point of the story, that man is Elton John. No.
The point is, that cat, of course, I didn't follow him. I didn't tag him like a shark and follow him for the rest of the next 10 years or his life or whatever. But, you know, the dude had to make a decision right there. Either he continues being a fan of the stuff we do, or he continues being kind of like, I fucking gay scare me. Any dick that's not mine terrifies me. And chances are the dude's stuck around, because we've sold a shitload of merchandise at our website. He's got to be one of them. So I always like to think of it as like, I've got him sitting there, whip a little message at him, whip a little moral at him, whip a little of what my view of the world is, because that's what every good filmmaker does. You know, you can't change the world, you can't cure the world. All you can do is be like, this is it through my eyes. Do you agree or not agree? And a lot of people seem to agree. Not a lot, you know. We've got fans, so they're smart. And we'll lead the world into the 21st century. And I'll make a profit on their backs. But you can't be responsible for your audience to some degree. You know, I mean, you put it out there, and hopefully they get it. And if they don't get it, what do you do? Hammer it at them? That's when the movie stops being entertaining. That's when you're on a soapbox, and you're being didactic, and you're just like, this is this, and that is that. You know, Dogma runs very dangerously close to being a didactic movie. But thankfully, every once in a while, Muse makes an ass-fucking joke, and, you know, people forget that we're talking about Jesus for a little while. So it's a dangerous line, but you know, you gotta give me credit. I have done flicks where they're far more gay friendly than most. Yeah?
Yeah. Thanks.
No. Please stop. Leela's the smartest one in the room because right now everyone knows that she's gay. So she can easily get a date at the end of this thing. People are like, you're that gay chick. I'm gay too.
What are you doing after the show? Oh, wait.
See, you can't hold me responsible for that. Rock on. That's a tough balancing act. Tough balancing act. Don't like him, need his money. Just kidding. All right, enough being political. Let's do some dick jokes. Who's next? This side.
Okay, my name is Graydon Blue.
Again?
Graydon Blue.
Graydon.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you. I'm starting production on my own movie very soon, and I was wondering if you had any advice or money for me.
No. Chapstick. Just.
Do you have any advice on how to get money? I mean, how to get funding for a film?
Yeah, head works a lot. And if you don't want to give head, you know.
I was hoping to not have to do that, if there are easier ways.
If you're very conservative like yourself, credit cards I find work very well. You can get a bunch of credit cards.
I was actually thinking about doing that.
Do you have any credit cards?
I've got one. It's maxed out already.
Which is it?
It's a MasterCard.
Is it yours or parents?
Mine.
Is it? All right. Yeah. So you can build on that.
Yeah.
Do you have a job?
Not at the moment.
All right, here's what you do. You find a video store, like a mom-and-pop video store, not like a chain. You don't want to work at a Blockbuster or what do they have out
there? Dear God, no.
No. Some of these people do want to work at Blockbuster. Make sure you're working the desk all the time so that you answer the phone. Get a bunch of credit card applications.
Mm-hmm.
Fill them all out. Okay. Say that you're the manager of the video store and you make $50,000 a year.
All right.
Then, when they call in to check, say, yes, he works here, he is the manager, and he makes $50,000 a year. Okay. And they start sending you credit cards. That's how I got all my credit cards. I would just answer the phone at RC Video and be like, yeah, Kevin Smith, he's our manager, excellent manager, makes $50,000 a year. The highest paid manager in the video business.
Okay.
Credit cards are the best scam on earth. Get a bunch of credit cards. That's my advice.
Cool. All right. Thank you.
You guys are so polite. You're going to applaud for everybody that asks a question? Just like that. It was a good question. Terrible answer. Good question.
When you made Clerks, you said you maxed out your credit cards and borrowed money and everything. That's a pretty big leap. You know, what kept you going while you were making the film?
It just seemed like to make sense at the time. Like I was a kid.
Sorry.
I was trying to give the brother something from my heart. Are you done?
I'm done. I'm
it just felt like it was the time to do it. I was young. You know, I was 22, 23 at the time. And, you know, if you're going to do something stupid, like charge up a bunch of film stuff on your credit cards, then do it while you're kind of young.
Hello, my name's Geek.
What is it?
Oh, my name's Geek. Anyway, you said that sucking dick is a great way to make money. I was wondering if I could suck yours for like $5.
Wait. Who's $5?
Well, I was wondering if I could get paid because I'm kind of broke at the moment.
So you want me to pay you $5?
Yeah, man. I mean, if you really want me to pay you to suck your dick, I think I might be down for it just so I could say I suck Kevin Smith's dick. Anyway,
why does everyone boo that? Sucking
dick
is a good thing.
You want to suck a dick too. Anyway, my real question is, you were supposed to be making Clerks 2 before you made Janet Silent Bob Strike Back.
Yes.
Whatever happened to the script for that? And could it be found in the anime?
I'm still wrapping
movie?
My head around the notion of you sucking my dick. And your name's Geek?
Yeah, my name's Geek. G-E-E-K, I think.
Do you know what the origin of the term is?
No, I don't. Want to explain
it? A geek is somebody that bites the heads off chickens in the circus.
I can be down for that.
I would never let you suck my dick with a name like Geek. Now, if your name was Ron...
Anyway, so what happened to the script?
With which script?
Clerks. What happened to the script for Clerks 2?
Clerks 2. I don't know. You can't get up there and start talking about dick sucking and then segue into a question.
You opened yourself up for it.
Pardon?
You opened yourself up for it. You said that sucking dick was a great way to make money. I want to make some money.
I didn't open myself up for anything.
Hey.
They're sending you a message, Geek. What happened to Clerks 2? It became Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. Huh. Okay.
I got $5.
That's another reason why you'll never see my name next to Scorsese, Woody Allen, and Spike Lee. Scorsese speaks a lot at NYU, and I'm damn skiffy. Nobody's ever been like, I'll suck your dick for $5. Not during the lecture, anyway. Oh, your turn.
Sorry, that kid stole my question. I was just curious, you've had your run-ins with the Catholic League and most recently GLAAD. I was just curious, within...
Isn't that weird? I had my run-ins with GLAAD, yet I was entertaining the notion of having my dick sucked by that guy. Where's GLAAD now, you know?
I was just curious, have you had, besides the whole run with Michael Eisner, have you had any confrontational experiences within the industry? Paul Thomas Anderson getting a little angry at your public bash of Magnolia, not really.
Not at all. I ran into Paul Thomas Anderson as I was getting my physical for Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. Isn't that weird? Why is that funny? Because you're like, you and physical should never be in the same. No, when you're about to direct a movie, they make you take a physical because they have to insure the movie and they insure the director in case the director drops dead of a heart attack if he smokes a lot and eats really bad food. So I'm in there getting my physical and I'm sitting in, I haven't gotten it yet, I'm sitting there filling out the paperwork, wondering if I'm going to have to drop trow and have my balls grabbed, wondering if I'll have to pay for it.
or if he'll pay me. And I hear a guy go, Kevin, hello. And I look up and it's PTA, it's Paul Thomas Anderson. And I was like, hey man, how are you? And he's like, good, good. What are you doing? I was like, just getting my physical. He said, well, so what are you doing? He said, getting mine. I said, what are you shooting? He said, movie with Adam Sandler. I said, oh, great. And he said, good to see you. I said, good to see you. And he left. And after he left, I was just like, oh my God. That's a motherfucker I bitch slapped on the internet. And he was so classy, you know, he didn't say anything about it. He wasn't like, I wasn't even looking. The dude was behind me. So he couldn't come up behind me with a fucking chair and been like, you know, nothing like, he was like, hey, Kevin. And he could have then hit me with a chair just so I'd see it was him. Like, that would have been my move. I would have been like, hey, Paul, you know, if he said something about me. But he was real classy, and I thought that was really kind of cool. Then I felt bad for my comment. Then I was like, ugh, I shouldn't have said that.
Have there been any run-ins with, like, studio execs?
Who actually did hit me with a chair?
Yeah, no. I guess having to make compromises, I mean, are there things that you wanted to do, but you were just too held back because of test audiences, executive decisions, things like that?
You got all serious on me. We were having fun. Have there been any... Well, when I was working on Mallrats, there were notes that I didn't like, and actually, since it was my second movie, I wound up taking them. I didn't find the diplomatic way around avoiding the notes. I just bought into it. For example, there was a scene in Mallrats where Jay and Silent Bob and Brody and T.S. are in the food court, talking about scars they've gotten from going down on girls. And when I handed in the script, they were like, this will not be funny. No audience will find this funny. It's too racy. It's too offensive. This doesn't belong in a movie. And I was like, all right. And I pulled it out and put it in a better movie. Then the other scene was there was a sequence where Jay and Silent Bob throughout the movie are running around the fucking mall and shit. And one of the running gags in the first and second draft was they were constantly busting in on Gwen when she's trying on shit. And one of the times, they were in a booth next to her, and there was a little hole in the wall, and they were peeking through it like Porky style. It was my homage to that great cinema epic Porky's. And Silent Bob starts jerking off, and he jerks off, and he shoots up in the air, and it comes over, and it lands in Gwen's hair. And she screams, and they go tearing ass out. And then the next time you see Gwen, when she meets up with T.S. and Brody, she still has it matted in her hair, and her hair looks all funky. And that was in the script, and they were like, that's not funny. No, I swear, my hand to God, this is a true story. That's not funny. Nobody will ever pay to see that. You will turn off an audience with cum in the hair type jokes. And so I said, all right, and I took it out. And then somebody else put it in their movie. They didn't take my idea. I think they kind of, you know, great minds think alike. And they did it, and their movie made like $120 million. So I was always perturbed about that. But that was the only time during Mallrats. We were so new to the process, we just believed whatever we were told. Because we wanted to make the movie for $2 million, and they were like, no, 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 it's going to be $6 million. We're like, why? $6 million? We don't have to make a movie for $6 million. Why not? We can make it for two. It's small. It's a couple kids running around a fucking mall. It doesn't cost that much money. It's not like it has a rubber poop monster in it or something. And they said, you can't make a movie for less than $6 million. I said, we made a movie for only $28,000. They're like, that's not a real movie now, is it? Should have known right there. Should have. And I sat there going, I guess you're right. I guess it's not. Maybe it'll be a cartoon one day. So we kind of bought into it early on. And then you grow older and you're like, wait a second, I have more power than this. And you start, you know, ignoring certain things, particularly bad notes about removing come in hair jokes.
Thanks.
And just on the topic that you brought on comic books now, the situation, the true Hollywood story, if you will, with the Superman Lives, and whether it was you who didn't want Tim Burton to go down with it, or if he just wasn't happy with what you had done with it, or what your take was on.
For those of you who don't know, because this is going back a few years now, back in like 96, 97, at one point I was commissioned by Warner Brothers to write a script for a new Superman movie. And how it came about, I think, was that somebody saw Mallrats, somebody at Warner Brothers, some studio exec, and was just like, watched Brody and T.S. talk about the kryptonite condom. And they were like, this guy seems to know a lot about Superman.
So I got called in for a meeting at Warner Brothers, and they said there's a couple of projects that you can rewrite, because at this point the script for Chasing Amy had started to circulate, and people were like, oh, he can write after all. So they were like offering me rewrite work. So I went into Warner Brothers and said, we have three projects we could throw your way. I said, all right, what are they? And they said, one is a remake of an Outer Limits episode called The Architects of Fear. The second is Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian. To which I was like, really, didn't we say all we needed to say with the first Beetlejuice? Must we go tropical? And the third was a project called Superman Reborn, and that's what piqued my interest. I was like, Superman? You guys are going to make another Superman movie? And they said, we're thinking about it. I said, can I would love to do that. And they said, well, that's a long shot. I can't give you that right here in the room. That has to go through a bunch of people because it's a big Warner Brothers franchise. So I said, well, what do I have to do? Whose fucking dick do I have to suck to get this job? And thankfully he didn't say his. But he said, you know what, why don't you take the script home? We have a draft of it. Take it home, read it, and tell me what you think about it. So I said, all right. I read the script, and I was just like, this is fucking terrible. This is a horrible script. I mean, it was just really, really bad. It was kind of like the Batman TV show version of a Superman movie. Very campy. So I went back to Warner Brothers 2 days later and sat down with the dude, and he was like, what'd you think? I said, well, it was really quite bad. And he was like, well, bad meaning good? And I said, no, bad, just fucking terrible. And he said, he's looking at me, and I'm just going on for about 5 minutes how bad the script is. And I was like, do you pay somebody to write this? Is this somebody's, the writer of this script, somebody's fucking cousin? Because who lets somebody write this script? Do somebody, you pay this dude? Can you get the money back? Because this is horrendous, dude, horrendous. And he was looking at me, nodding and going, all right, well, thanks for coming in. So I left and I was driving home. I got home and I called my friend Walter, who's back in Jersey, and he's a big comic book fan. And I was like, dude, I just went into Warner Brothers and told them the script for Superman sucked. Ah. Rebel, rebel, Jersey represent. Ah. Fuck Hollywood. Ah. And Walter's like, well, why didn't you just offer to write a better version? And I was like, ah. Because I hadn't thought of that. I said, fuck. But it didn't matter because the next day I got a call from my agent and he was like, hey, they want to see you at Warner Brothers again. I said, really? All right. So I went back and it was the same dude that I talked to originally, the same studio exec, and then there was another dude in the room with him. So I sat down with him and the first guy was like, glad you came back. Do me a favor, tell him what you told me about Superman, about the script. And I was like, all right, it's bad, sucks, did your cousin write it, blah, blah, blah. Did that for about 5 minutes and then they both just nodded at me quietly and then they're like, all right, well, thanks for coming in. So I went back home. Next day, I got another call from my agent going, they want to meet with you at Warner Brothers again. I said, all right. Because I really didn't have much to do. So I go back into the room, and it's that dude, the second dude, and now there's a third dude in the room. And they're all in a semicircle chairs, and they put me in one chair, and the first guy's like, tell this guy what you told us about the Superman script. And I just imagined it as a real kind of water cooler situation. Like one dude standing around the water cooler and somebody else was there as well getting some coffee and he was just like, you should hear what the fucking Clerks dude said about the Superman script. And the guy's like, what'd he say? And he was like, well, you know what, fuck it, I'll just bring him in. So I told them again, and it went on like that. It went on like that for almost a whole straight week. I would go back, there'd be another person in the room. And I kept saying the same shit over and over. And finally I got to the guy at the top, who was Lorenzo de Bonaventura. Now there's like 6 to 8 guys sitting around a large table with Lorenzo at the one end and me at the other. And they're all like, tell Lorenzo what you told us about Superman. And so I launch into my spiel and shit. And Lorenzo's the first guy who's like, well, what would you do differently? And I said, well, I hadn't thought about it, but I mean, I guess you could try this, 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 and that, and that. And he's nodding and shit, and he's like, well, you know what, we're going to give a shot at it. And I said, all right, awesome. And he goes, it's pending approval of the producer. And I said, who's the producer? And they said, John Peters. I said, all right, what do I got to do? They're like, you got to go meet with him. I said, okay. Now, John Peters, if you don't know, he's a producer on movies. Like, he was an exec producer, or producer in name only on Rain Man. He was a producer on Batman. He was a producer on the main event, the Barbra Streisand boxing movie. Which is how he got his start in the business. He used to be Barbra Streisand's hairdresser. And then one day he became a producer. Because in Hollywood, you just kind of fail upwards. So anyway, I'm going to meet John Peters, and I go to his place, and he was hardcore producer on Batman. He was there every day. It was kind of his baby from beginning to end. And when you get to his house, it kind of shows, because it's kind of like driving up to Wayne Manor. This is a big mansion through woods and shit like that, and it looks like there's a holographic cave to one side. So you get up and shit, and they bring you in, and he shows up, and he's wearing like short tennis shorts and shit, and he's kind of a built dude, but he's got a perfect head of hair, like well coiffed or coiffed. So I come down and sit down with him. He says, "They tell me you got to take on Superman." I said, I do." He says, "Let me hear it," and I tell it to him. And after a while, I'm done. He's just nodding, looking at me, nodding. He goes, "You know why you and me are going to do a good job on Superman?" And I said, "Why?" He's going, "Because you and me, we get Superman. You know why?" I said, "No." He said, "Because you and me, we're from the streets." Now, I grew up in suburban New Jersey. Never saw a black man until I was about 28. Like, I'm the farthest thing from the streets there are. You know, I grew up on a street, but not on the streets. And I'm looking at this guy going, like, "I'm from the suburbs, you're a hairdresser, neither of us are from the street." But I don't want to say that, because fuck it, I want the job. So I said, "Who would you see playing Superman?" And he said, "If I had to cast it right now?" I said, "Well, yeah." And he said, "Sean Penn." And I was like, "Spicoli?" Because it was an interesting choice. And he's like, "Yeah, did you see Dead Man Walking?" Because that was out at the time. And I said, "Yeah." And he's going, "Well, look in his eyes in that movie. He's got the eyes of a violent, caged animal, of a fucking killer." And I was like, "Dude, it's Superman." He's like, "I got some directives for you if you're going to move forward on the process. Some things I want you to do and don't in the script." He's going, "Three things." Okay, I said, "All right." It's one, I don't want to see him in that suit. Two, I don't want to see him fly. And three, he's got to fight a giant spider in the third act. And I'm like, let's go back to one. When you say you don't want him in the suit, he's like, "Don't want to see him in it. Don't want it. It looks too faggy," he goes. And I was just like, "No fags on the street, I take it." But I don't say that because I want the fucking job. So he said, flying, I don't want to see him fly. I said, "Well, that's kind of the suit, and flying defines Superman. So don't want to see it. Don't want to see him fly. No scenes where he's flying around carrying people. Horseshit." I said, all right, no flying. I said, "But the giant spider intrigues me." Why that? And he's like, "Do you know anything about spiders?" And I said, "No. And he said, "Well, they're the fiercest killers in the insect kingdom." And I was like, what's that have to do with our non-flying Superman? And he said, "Because there's going to be a scene in this movie, a scene that I want. When I saw King Kong when I was a kid, there's a scene where the doors open up and King Kong's revealed, and it's a real big moment. I want that moment in this movie. I want some doors to open up and a big fucking spider's there." So I was just like, "All right, I'll give it a shot." So I went back to Warner Brothers and sat down with them, and they said, "We heard from him. He likes you. We're going to hire you. You're going to move forward." Did he bring up the spider? I said, "He did. He brought up the spider. He tell you guys about the spider?" Like, "Every day with the fucking spider." I said, "What should I do?" They're like, "Just do it, but try not to call it a spider. Can you call it something else?" And I was just like, "Thanagarian snare beast?" And they're like, "Okay, go." So I was ready to go start writing, and then I was told I had to write an outline first. And I was just like, "What do you mean, an outline?" They said, "Yeah, don't just write the script. You have to give us an overview of the story so we can approve the story so we can go write the script, and we need you to write an outline." I said, "Can I include dialogue?" They said, "Yeah, go ahead." And then dialogue's about the only thing I know how to do. So I went home and wrote 80 pages, just an 80-page outline with tons of dialogue and very few kind of prose passages.
And so I turned it in, and I was in Los Angeles all this time. I wanted to go back to Jersey. I turned in, I say, I'm finished. I'm going to go back to Jersey and let me know what you guys think, and you can reach me back home. And they said, well, first off, this is 80 pages. And I was like, yeah, that's the outline. They're like, an outline is like 4 pages max. And I was just like, well, you know, I'm just overcompensating because I grew up fat. They said, second off, you can't leave. You got to stick around here and read John the outline. And I said, what do you mean, read John the outline? They said, yeah, he likes to have the outlines read to him by the writer. I said, what do I have, fucking tuck him in when I'm done, too? So I go back up to fucking Wayne Manor. I sit down with John, and John puts me in a chair, and he's got a couch in this huge fucking living room. He lays down on the couch, and he goes... And I said, what's with that? And he's like, I like to visualize the movie while it's being read to me. So I'm looking at it up here. He was building a little screen in his mind's eye. This was a screen. So I was just like, all right, here we go. And I start reading. And since it's Superman, you know, you tend to use the term Superman a lot. And I didn't want to keep doing that. It gets a little boring. So being a comic book fan, I changed it up. Called him Kal-El when he was on Krypton, you know, Man of Tomorrow, Man of Steel, shit like that. So I'm reading the first few pages when he's on Krypton when he's a baby, because I have to redo the origin. And it's Kal-El this, Kal-El that, blah, 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 blah. And he's like, wait a second. Who the fuck is Kal-El? And I was like, Kal-El is Superman. He's going, all right, why? And I was like, that's his Kryptonian name. He goes, I'm like, Krypton's where he's from? He's like, right, fucking planet, boom. All right. Go. So we go back into it and shit, and I read it, and when I'm all done, he's like, all right, I think we got a movie here. He's going, the problem, though, you're missing some beats, some action beats. You need an action beat. Every 10 pages, something big has to happen. I said, well, what are you thinking about? He's like, well, it's just an example. Like, when you go, you have a scene where Brainiac goes to the Fortress of Solitude looking for Superman. Superman's dead at this point. Hope I didn't spoil the movie for anybody. So Brainiac's looking for him in the Fortress of Solitude, and something should happen there. There should be a big fucking fight. I'm like, but Superman's dead at this point. He's like, I know, but can't Brainiac fight something else up there? And I was like, well, like what? He's like, what about like Superman's guards, his soldiers? And I'm like, why would Superman need guards? You know, he's Superman. He's, and plus it's called the Fortress of Solitude. Nobody's up there. And he said, well, Jesus Christ. He's going, what about, where is it? It's in the Antarctic? I said, yeah. He's like, what about polar bears? And I was like, polar bears? He said, yeah, have them fight some polar bears. Brainiac shows up. He's trying to get in the fortress. Polar bears come at him, and he just fucking kills one, and one runs away. Because we don't want to piss off the PETA people. And I said, you want me to write a scene where Brainiac is razzling polar bears? He says, yeah, you know anything about polar bears? And I said, no, I don't. He's like, polar bears are the fiercest killers in the animal kingdom. And at this point, I'm just like, this dude has way too much access to the Discovery Channel. So I get done with my first draft, and I send it in, and they like it and whatnot. They start sending it off to people. They send it off to Nick Cage, Tim Burton. During this time, we have the premiere for Chasing Amy. I invite John, because I know this dude doesn't know anything about my work. In fact, I don't think anybody at Warner Brothers knows much about my work beyond having read the script for Chasing Amy. Because I was always afraid somebody at Warner Brothers would be like, we gave our fucking million-dollar, multi-million-dollar franchise to the Clerks guy? Like, he's going to turn in a script with fucking Clark, you know, jumping on Lois going, how many fucking dicks did you suck?
So I figured it was fair to kind of invite the producer of the movie I was writing to see my new movie. So I said, we're having this premiere for Chasing Amy. You want to come? I said, yeah, yeah. He showed up, and I talked to him the next day on the phone. I said, what'd you think? He was going, interesting, interesting flick, which in Hollywood means I didn't like it at all. He's going, you know what I really like, though? He's going, the black guy, the gay black guy. I like that. I like that a lot. I like his voice. I said, yeah, yeah, Dwight. He's very funny. And he said, that's what we need in our movie. And I was like, you want Dwight to be in the movie? I know he'd fucking be happy to do it. He said, no, we just need that voice. We need that character, somebody like him in our movie. Can't Brainiac have a sidekick? And I was like, yeah, I guess. And he said, give him a little robot sidekick and give him that dude's voice. I said, really? You want the robot to sound like a gay black man? And he said, that's what this movie needs, is a fucking, just a gay R2-D2. And at this point, the Star Wars movie was in re-release, and it opened up that previous weekend, made like $30 million and shit like that, and he had gone to see it again. So he was like, we need more shit like that in our movie. We need something that'll, like, we can make toys of and shit like that, like Chewie. We need Chewie in this movie. And I was like, you want me to just fucking write Chewie into the movie? Superman razzling Chewie? And he said, no, but just something like that. Like, maybe Brainiac has a dog, and it's a little cute dog, and we can make a toy out of it. Because that's what it's about. We got to sell some toys off this movie. So that's what I need in this movie. I said, I don't really know if that's going to work. He said, don't tell me it's not going to work. I want my Chewie. And I was like, I got your fucking Chewie right here. But I don't say that, because I like the job. So Tim Burton and Nick Cage sign on based on my draft. And I was kind of excited. I said, that's kind of neat. You know, fucking Tim Burton, Batman, and Nick Cage, you know. Fucking Nick Cage. But when Tim Burton got signed on to the project, Tim Burton signed a pay or play deal, which essentially means no matter what happens, Tim Burton gets paid whatever his directing fee was. I think at that point it was $10 million, $5 to $10 million. Tim Burton, once he signs the deal, turns around and says, I'm going to bring on my guys to write a script. And the Warner Brothers guys were like, well, what about the script we're developing? And he said, I don't want to use that. I want to do my own script. Presumably a version of Superman where he has scissors for hands. So they turn around, they tell me, like, Kevin, we're kind of done. Tim wants to go another way with a new writer. And I was like, all right. You know, I wasn't really that upset. I didn't feel, because I'd worked on it for 2 drafts, and I got to hang out with a really fucked up, kooky dude. A dude who I can tell stories about for the rest of my life. And, like, they paid me a lot of money to do it. Like, I would have done it for free, but I didn't tell them that. But they paid me a bunch of money to do it. And it was just fun. Like, I got to work on Superman. I got incredible access into the DC archives and shit like that. And people would give me free Superman shit all the time because I was working on it. And then I got shit canned off, and I started throwing Superman stuff away because who needs to be reminded? But I was really reminded the next summer when I went to the movies and saw a movie that John Peters had produced. And it was called The Wild Wild West. So I'm sitting in the theater watching the movie. I'm like, good Lord, this is a piece of shit. But then all of a sudden, like a giant fucking spider shows up.
Just a quick follow-up question. Did you enjoy Batman, just since the same people were...
Did I enjoy Batman? Yeah, I enjoyed Batman. I mean, with all its flaws and shit. Yeah, absolutely. When the movie came out, like, I had no idea I ever wanted to be in film. I was just a guy that watched movies and shit. And that summer was huge. You couldn't turn around without seeing the bat signal somewhere. People were cutting it into their fucking heads. It was just like, it was a summer of Batman. If you were a comic book fan, it was pretty hot. And I was real deep into it at that point. I had just gotten back into comics, so suddenly Batman was everywhere. So I was a big fan. But Tim Burton, I guess, like, you know, ever since the Superman incident, people will bring me copies of the script. Like, they buy at comic book conventions or buy off the internet, and they hand it to me, and like, would you autograph? I say, all right. And I always write, fuck Tim Burton. Because I figure he'll never see it. But I guess Tim Burton finally saw one. Because during the summer,
Right before Jay and Bob came out and after Planet of the Apes came out, there was a piece that ran in the New York Post on page 6 in which Tim Burton chewed me a new asshole. At the end of Planet of the Apes movie, I hope I'm not spoiling it for anybody, like, Marky Mark goes back to fucking present day. It is fucking Marky Mark. I don't care what he calls himself now. It was just like, feel it, you know? The underwear dude. So Marky Mark goes back to the present day and lands in front of the Lincoln Memorial and gets out, and Lincoln Memorial has a monkey's head on it, a little chimp head or something. And the cops get out, and they're all monkeys, and he's like, ah! And the audience is like, what? So I'm talking to this dude who writes for the New York Post named Lou Luminick. And he's a friend of mine. He's been covering our stuff from, like, the early get-go on Clerks, because he used to live in Bergen County in Jersey. So he goes, we were talking about the Apes. I was like, see, yeah, what'd you think? Oh, it's fucking terrible. Yeah, it was real bad. It was terrible. Let's just try to ignore it and pretend it never happened. I said, but there's one thing in that movie I found really fucking interesting, a weird coincidence. I said, you got the Jay and Silent Bob miniseries. I'd done this comic book miniseries called Chasing Dogma that took place between the movies Chasing Amy and Dogma. When they leave Chasing Amy, the comic book story happens, and the tail end of the comic book story, and the last page, they enter Dogma. So it was a little miniseries that bridged it and kind of fun to do. And we used a whole section of it for the last movie, Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. The whole section with the monkey came right out of the comic book. So at one point, just like in the movie where Jay is imagining what's going to happen when monkeys take over the planet, or if monkeys took over the planet, we did that in the comic book, same montage, but there was one additional shot in the comic book that wasn't in the movie, which was a bunch of apes pulling the head off the Lincoln Memorial and replacing it with a monkey head. So when I saw Planet of the Apes, I was like, that's fucked up. I put that in a comic book once. That's so weird. So I was on the phone with Lou. I was like, pick up your copy of Chasing Dogma. I said, go to this page. And he's looking at it. He's going, oh my God, it's just like the thing in the movie. I said, isn't that fucked up? Great minds think alike, motherfucker. So he said, you want to say something about it? We can make a piece out of this, little piece for the paper. I said, all right, because I'm a press whore. I will do anything to see my name in print. So I was just like, yeah, great. Even though it wasn't news, I was like, all right. He said, what do you have to say about it? I said, I'm really mad. I feel like I've been ripped off, and I am contemplating legal action. We're on the phone like, ee. 40-year-old guy, 30-year-old guy, ee. So he's like, you mind if I call Tim Burton and get a comment? I said, go ahead, let's get Tim on it. That'll be awesome. So the piece runs in the paper 2 days later on page 6. And it said, Smith furious at Burton, or something akin to that. And I read the article, and my quotes don't come off as like, I feel I'm pissed off. It says, he's very pissed off. He feels ripped off, and he's currently contemplating legal action. And I'm going like, that's not what I said at all. I didn't say it. I was like, tee-hee-hee-hee. Well, you know, that's not in the article. Where's the tee-hee-hee-hee? And in the piece, it said, when asked for comment, Tim Burton said, anybody that knows me knows that I would never read a comic book. Which, to me, explains fucking Batman. But it said, then the next quote was, and I would especially never read anything created by Kevin Smith. And I was just like, holy shit, man. Like, the claws came out. The scissor hands came out. Because Tim, I don't know if you've ever seen him in interviews or seen him, like, you know, I think they did an Annie biography on him, I'm not sure. But I've seen stuff with Tim, and Tim is always like, I'm a goofy artist, you know. I'm goth, and I just like movie magic, you know. Just like a real artsy-fartsy fucking weirdo. And he wears the black, and he wears big fucking Jackie O glasses, and he's got the hair that kind of goes up and cascades. He just looks like an art school student, always like this, you know? Doesn't dress nice like this. But suddenly, Tim went from being like, I'm just a very kooky guy, to like, fuck Fat Smith! Fuck him up his ass! I'm Tim Burton! Who the
fuck does he think I stole from him? Fuck you! You know, the verbal equivalent in the press. And I was flabbergasted, taken aback, because I'm just like, I'm used to fucking saying shit about people left and right. Nobody ever says anything back because people are fairly political. But for one brief moment, Tim Burton was just like, the gloves are off! Let's go. So I called up Lou. I was like, Lou, what'd you do to me? What's going on here, man? And he's going, I told you it was going to be a page six story. I said, I didn't know you were going to run it like it was a serious item. He said, yeah, well, he's going, once I got the Tim Burton quote, I thought it was great. I was like, yeah, but did you read it? He said, yeah, it's funny as hell. I was like, Lou, it's funny to me and you. Everyone else thinks, I got people fucking calling me, CNN, fucking the LA Times. They want to know when I'm going to start suing 20th Century Fox. Like, we were tee-hee-hee. And he said, well, look, man, just be happy because, like, he had more to say. Because Lou, after we got done talking, called up Tim's publicist. Tim's publicist's name is Bumble Ward. I'm not making it up. I'm going to say it one more time. Tim's publicist's name is Bumble Ward. There is somebody on this planet named Bumble. Bumble fucking Ward. He calls Bumble and he's like, Kevin Smith said this about Tim and about Planet of the Apes. Would Tim like to make a comment? And Bumble Ward, he said at first, was just like, no. Click. And so Lou started writing his article and the phone rang 5 minutes later and it was Bumble Ward again. And she said, Tim does in fact have a statement. And he's like, okay, what is it? And she read off that statement that he fucking printed. So apparently, like, Bumble was just like, what is he, fucking 10? He's got nothing to say to that. And was talking to Tim, was just like, fucking the dude that made Clerks was saying shit, like you stole the ending of Planet of the Apes from his comic book. And Tim was like, he said, what? Get them back on the phone. Here's my statement, fucking... I would never read anything creative like Kevin Smith. So Lou said, be happy that I went to press as soon as I did, because 10 minutes later, Bumble Ward called back to say, like, Tim has more statements to make. Like, apparently Tim was just like, I'm fucking... And say this, too. He's fucking... He's ugly and his mother dresses him funny. And fucking... Mallrats was stupid and fucking... His wife's got big ears, She... But he'd gone to press, so he couldn't put it in the article. So I always thought that if I ever write a book one day, like if I ever write a novel or something like that, and you have to put quotes on the back of the novel, little review blurbs and shit, like, it's a great read, fucking Smith knocks one out of the park, I'm going to take that Tim Burton quote and use that as the last quote. I would especially never read anything created by Kevin Smith.
Hi, I'm going to play the bad guy in this situation. Union Board has come up and told me 5 times to cut it off, so I'm sorry.
Kevin.
It's just the way that this is set up. I'm sorry.
Kevin,
nothing against you. I've enjoyed this evening. I've enjoyed listening to you.
Oh, man, no, that's cool.
But you know what? Hey, everyone, if you want to, he's going to be out in the lobby if you want to meet him. So the quicker that he goes out in the lobby, you can meet him in the lobby and chit-chat all you want.